On the very last page of Lois W.'s book, Lois Remembers, she writes, she used to think that thinking was the most important function in her life, but that she had learned through the AA experience that loving was her most supreme function. The heart precedes the mind. This old gal from way down in South Georgia is just about the lovingest, livingest, sharingest, caringest gal that you have ever known. Gives me a great deal of pleasure this morning to introduce to you humble, honest Cody's wife, Betty.
My name is Betty Cody, and I'm a slowly recovering, fairly happy Al-Anon. I had been asked to tell you something about these people that left me. Dot is the past delegate for the state of Georgia, Al-Anon. Ruth is the past delegate, and Carol is the present delegate. Now, I have envied many people many things, but I do not envy them their titles of delegate. They have and do hold a very important station in the program of Al-Anon, but you know they're never too busy to answer a question or to share. And more important than them sharing on the state level, they share on their local level. And to me, that's where it is on the local level. When you forget from where you came in the small group, you need to start over again. I do want to introduce you to my husband, Cody. Now, his name is Herbert. I call him Cody. He calls himself Humble Honest as a joke. So you can call him just anything you want to. Cody, would you please say it? We have gotten where we play a little game called Rummy Cube. I want to explain this humble honest, and his initials are HH, and so we've talked about that, and so it's just a joke. He doesn't really feel that way, I hope. Today I'm up here to share with you my life. My actions, my reactions, and my thoughts. My thoughts were not pretty. My actions were not nice. And my reactions were even worse than that. I don't tell you any of these things in a bragging sort of way. This was what my life was. This is how I did. It's how I was affected. And when I came into this program and started to work the program, and I didn't come in the first meeting. It took a year and a half for me before I began to work this program. I was told that I had to get honest with me. It didn't matter how honest I was with anybody else, but with me, I had to get honest before I could grow. My inventory was a very painful thing for me to take. The first one I did, I skimmed. And it took many inventories for me before I got down to a lower level, a lower core peeled off these peelings that I could begin to share. I think that one of the gifts that God has given to me is the ability to stand up here and share with you my gut level feelings and my actions. Because before this program, I would not have let you know anything of the bad things about me. I would have put my best foot forward if I had known which foot was the best. And I would not have told you anything that you could have held against me, over me, or have thought she was not nice. The things that I'm going to share with you today are important that I remember. Because I can look back and I remember these and I remember where I came from and try to know where I'm going. I'm not well, but I'm better. I hope I got a friend in here, at least one. And I've had one hand raised. I've got some hometown people here that have known me for 20 years, and they knew me when. I was the only child in my family, and you would think from this that I would have been spoiled and would have been loved. My daddy loved me, and I knew he loved me. But after I came into this program and really took my inventory and had to admit how I felt about my mother, that was a hard thing for me. Because I had to admit that I grew up resenting my mother and not loving this woman. But I also knew that she really didn't love me. She didn't want me. I was an unwanted child. My father worshipped my mother. And if she wanted anything, if she'd have wanted the moon, my daddy would have gotten it for her some way or another. And she was always first. And I was taught to wait on her and to do for her, even as a small child. He put her on a pedestal. And I said, I want to be up there. I want to be first in somebody's life. And once I got into this program and admitted my feelings toward this woman, because she was still alive, and I began to work on these things, I'm grateful to say to you today that the last 2 years that my mother lived, I learned to love her. Maybe not in the way that a child would have loved her parent had she loved her all along, but I loved her to the best of my ability. My mother had never told me that she loved me, but the night before she died, she told me for the first time in my life that she loved me, and she died on my birthday. So I feel like that the last 2 years, with the help of this program and with the help of God and you people, I did make some amends. Maybe not as many as I should have or could have, but I really don't have any guilt or regrets today. I did the best that I could. When I was in high school, I knew that I did not want to go to college, and so I worked the DCT program where I went to school a half a day, and I worked a half a day. Now, this is where I met Cody. I was introduced to him as Cody, and I still call him Cody. I've called him some worse things. But I decided that he was what I wanted, and I chased him till he caught me, and that's just the way it was, because he thought he was too old for me. He was in college. And, you know, I had always been a determined sort of person, and what I wanted, I went after, and I wanted him, and I went after him, and I got him, and sometimes later I tried to give him away, and nobody would have him. And I still got him. And I don't want to give him away today. I enjoy being with him. George, he still doesn't tell me he loves me. I used to ask him, Cody, do you love me? And he'd say, oh, hell yes. So with this program, I don't ask him, and he doesn't tell me, and we can both deal with that. But I know that he does, because he shows me that he does most of the time. But we got married, and when our youngest child was 2 years old, his father died, and we moved to South Georgia. Now, I was a city girl, Atlanta, and I did not know anything about hogs and cows then, and today I still don't like hogs and cows. And he liked farming. So we moved to Waycross, and we lived in the house with his mother for a while, and I pitched one of my temper tantrums that I was capable of throwing. And we moved from Waycross to Jessup, and if I thought I had been at the end of the world in Waycross, I knew I made it in Jessup. So we lived in Jessup for a while, and then we moved to Bacon County, and that's where we are now. Thank God we don't live on the farm. We live in town, and our children, our youngest son, lives on the farm. Cody used to ask me to help move the cows, you know, from one pasture to the other, and he would say, now you stand right here and don't let them go by you. And I'd say, all right. And they would come, and I would move, and they'd go where they wanted to. And him and Steve would cuss and carry on for a little while, so now they don't ask me to help with the cows, and I don't offer. You know, just leave them alone. But his drinking started. Now, you know, I knew when I was going with him that he drank, and it didn't bother me that he did, because my father drank, and my father's drink of choice was moonshine. And he carried his drink with him all the time, working and everywhere, but I never saw my daddy drunk. And he taught Cody to drink vodka, straight from the bottle, hot, no chaser, because that's how he drank it, and so that's how he taught Cody to drink it. And later on, you'll understand why I told you that. But the three things that I did, you know, I just don't have time to tell you, and you don't have time to listen to everything I did, so I'm just going to tell you some of the highlights and share with you those. And if anybody wants to try them, you know, if you just need to put them in the back of your mind, you says, you know, take what you like and leave the rest, but remember some of the things that you want to use later. But Thursdays was a bad day for me. We had opened a business, an office supply and printing business, and we closed a half a day on Thursday, and this was Cody's drinking day. He told me that he didn't hunt, fish, or run around, and his hobby was drinking. So he got real proficient in his hobby. And as his illness grew, so did mine. Now, I suffered from alcoholism, or the ism part of it. I never drank. I took a couple of drinks in my life, and they made me sick, and anything made me that sick I didn't want no part of, and so I just put it down. But, you know, I think today that God knew that our family couldn't stand two alcoholics, so he just let us have one and one sicker one. And I go home from the store on this Thursday, and Cody's drunk, and he tells me that we're going to Hazelhurst, which is about 25 miles or so from the house, that one of our customers wanted some merchandise that we didn't have. Well, I didn't care where we had it, didn't care where the customer got it, because I had got to this point where I didn't like me, I didn't like you, didn't like the customer, didn't give a damn where he traded with us or not. That's just how I felt. And he said, we're going to get this merchandise, and I said I wasn't going, and we had some few healthy discussions on that thing. And he says, you're going, and you're going to drive. Well, that should have told me something, because he didn't like my driving, drunk or sober, and I didn't like his, and it was sort of a mutual admiration society, but I got in the car, and I drove, and the further we went, the madder I got, and the faster I was going. And to the best of my knowledge, this is the first time that this man ever told me he wished he were dead, and I agreed with him. I just wished he were dead, too. My problems would be solved. And so my evil little thinking mind says, why don't you do something about it? And there was a bridge coming up, and I decided to hit the railing of the bridge. And right before I hit that bridge, I was going 95 miles an hour, and right before I hit it, I swerved, and I said, well, you stupid thing, you're in here, too. And I'm talking to myself. I've always talked to myself because other people didn't much want to talk to me. And so I swerved and I missed, and I know now that God was taking care of me. And somebody asked me, says, well, wasn't God taking care of him? I said, I don't know. I didn't care then. Don't care now. I just know that God was taking care of me. And so we get through this incident. Well, his drinking continues and my illness continues, and they both grow and we get real good at it. And I won't tell you about all the treatment centers that we sent him to, or the hospitals that he went to. We made everything in the state of Georgia except for Milledgeville. Now, the only reason we didn't make Milledgeville was because my pride wouldn't let him go there. That's the only reason. And some of the treatment centers he was thrown out of, and some he was in I should have been in, and I'm here to tell you, if it ever happens again, I go and he stays. Because they say that the Al-Anons are sicker than the alcoholics, and the sickest one needs the treatment, right? So I'm going. It'll be my turn. Hopefully, it'll never happen. And I don't worry about that today either. I might have to worry about that tomorrow, but I don't worry about that today. So time marches on, and he continues to drink. And like I said, at first it was just Thursday, and then it got to be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday that he practiced his hobby real good. And then after a time, it got to be every day. Now, Cody was a periodic drinker. Every few minutes, he periodically took a drink. So I go home on a Thursday, another Thursday, and he's in the bed drunk. His drunk bed. We still got that drunk. Most people had a drunk chair. He had a drunk bed. Because we live in a little small place, and where we happen to live is in the center of town, and we're 2.5 blocks from the funeral home, the police station, and we're about 3 blocks from the liquor store. And I want you to know, since he's quit drinking, they not only closed that liquor store, they moved the whole building. It's not even there. The man that did run it went around the world 3 times while Cody was drinking. And now he hadn't even been out of Bacon County. Every time I look up, he's right there. And I tell him so every once in a while. I ask him, isn't anybody else in Bacon County drinking besides him? But I go home this Thursday, and Cody has a real sarcastic attitude about him sometimes. He can just cut you with his sarcasm. And of course, I was a bitching and a fussing, and he says, if I had a gun, I'd shoot myself. Well, he thought he was safe because things had gotten so bad at our house that our children who did hunt, they were 15, 16, and 19 at the time, they had got all the guns out of the house between them and my neighbors taking care of my business. Because they was afraid Daddy would get drunk and hurt Mama. Now, giving my children the credit, they never thought that Mama would kill Daddy. I had them fooled. So he made this smart aleck statement that if I had a gun, I'd shoot myself. I said, wait a minute, I know where there's a gun. And there was a gun on the closet shelf in the bathroom, and I got me a chair, and I climbed up on that chair and reached on the back of that closet shelf, and I got the gun, and I got the bullets, and I loaded it. I've never loaded a gun before in a sense, but I loaded that one. And I laid it down on the bed by him, and I said, Cody, there's a gun. Shoot yourself. And he'd say, no, you do it. And I'd say, let's let it be double indemnity. Accidental death. I said, because. Now, see, we had been writing bad checks. I don't know if any of y'all ever wrote bad checks or not. But he would write a bad check, and then I'd write a bad check to cover the bad check. I'll tell you a little more about that in just a minute. But all day long, I walked by him, and I'd say, Cody, hadn't you shot yourself yet? And I'd move the gun where just his fingertips would touch it. You know, if he moved his fingers, he could feel it. He knew it was there. And so about 11 o'clock that night, I got ready to go to bed, and I was sleepy, and I said, Cody, would you just go ahead and shoot yourself, but would you get out on the floor? It's a tile floor. And I said, would you do that so that when you bled, you'd bleed on the floor and I could mop it up? Go ahead and get Marvin, that was the undertaker, to come and get you out of my way, and I'd go to bed and won't have the bed to clean up, you know, won't have the blood to clean up. And he wouldn't, and I didn't, and I went down to the other end of the house and went to sleep. As far as I know, I had a good night's sleep. So we get through this period of time. But going back to the insurance, you see, I had, in writing these bad checks, I had deducted in my mind now that if I wrote the insurance company a bad check, because I made sure his insurance was paid up, and if he were just to happen to die, that what I owed them for the bad check, they could deduct from what they owed me for him dying. And, you know, we wouldn't have any problems with that. Now, my bad check writing got so bad that the president of the bank called me one day, and he said, Betty, there's some checks down here that need to be covered. And at that time, we had some pine trees on the farm, and I had wanted something, and I had asked Cody to buy it, and he said, no, we couldn't afford it. And I said, well, Cody cut some pine trees, and he says, that's like money in the bank. So when the president of the bank called me, I said, cash it on one of those pine trees. That's like money in the bank. And I hung up the telephone. Now, no sane person hangs up on the president of the bank. Even if he is your friend, he might not stay your friend at that rate, you know. So we get through that period. Well, time marches on and his drinking gets really periodic, like I say, every few minutes. And by this time, I'm beginning to hate the store because I have put all of my problems on the store. I worked inside and we had hired a printer, and Cody worked outside. And I had thought if we didn't have this store, he wouldn't drink, because he said we were getting a little bit prosperous, and the more prosperous we got, the more he drank. And I hated this store to a point that when I would go in the back door to open up in the mornings, I would go in the bathroom, I would throw up, and then I would go outside to wait on you if you happened to come in. And we did have a good business. I'm grateful to say that 2 years after he got sober, we sold that thing. I gave him a 2 weeks notice, and he decided to close it. I had all that store I wanted, and we closed it. But when we closed it, we didn't owe anybody a dime on it, and I'm grateful for that. So time goes on, and I think it's along about in here that I had heard about Al-Anon. Now, you think things will begin to get better, because I did start going to Al-Anon, but they didn't get any better. They get just a little bit worse. And I had read in the newspaper about a man from Waycross that had been working with some alcoholics, and I called him, and I told him who I was. And he came to my house that night, drove 30 miles to come see me, and this is the first time that I heard about Al-Anon. And he told me to go to Al-Anon. Now, in my sick mind, I asked him what that was, and what I remember Jack saying was, it will help his drinking. Well, anything that would help his drinking was what I wanted some of, and so I go. Now, I was dumb, but I was not stupid, and Jack's a big man. He's over 6 feet tall and about 300 pounds, and he said, I'll be there to check on you. Well, I thought, you know, I better take the body. And that's what I did for 18 months. I took the body. I can identify with people today who say they don't get anything out of the first few meetings, because I didn't either. But I can't identify with the people who won't keep coming to see what you have to offer. Whatever reason I went, where it was through fear or madness. And I'll tell you about the first sponsor I had. I had a bad attitude, and I didn't want to hear anything y'all were telling me, because you see, you people in Al-Anon was telling me that I needed to love him. I needed to have compassion, I needed to have tolerance, I needed to have understanding, I needed to change my attitude. I wasn't the one drinking, why did I need to do all these changes? So I didn't want to hear anything you were saying. So one night this lady, her name is Alice, and she walked up and she pat me on the shoulder and she says, you need a sponsor, and I'm it. Well, I'm here to tell you I helped her program. She had to work on her program to keep me. Her husband was one of the best AAs I have ever known. He's dead now. We met on Tuesday night and Wednesday mornings by 8 o'clock. He would have been at my house, and he had to drive 25 miles. And you know, they didn't come to talk to Cody about his drinking, because Cody was still drinking. They came to talk to me. And it would make me so mad, and I'd say, I don't have to take this, I don't have to listen to that, and she'd give me instructions what to do. And I'd think, I'm going to do better this week, and I couldn't wait till the next Tuesday to get there and tell her. And I'd say, Alice, I've done so and so and so, and she'd say, yes, but. Well, you know, I could never please that woman. There just was no pleasing her. And the AAs, they passed me from one AA to the other. And Wade would tell me to my face, I've had all of her I can stand. You take her. It's your turn. And they did that to me. And I'm sorry today I was that bad, but that's just how I was. But I'm grateful that they took the time. It wasn't just the Al-Anons that worked with me. It was the AAs too. So we go. And I don't get any better, and Cody doesn't get any better. And it gets to be a Thursday, and I go home, and he's drunk, and I'm mad. You know, I didn't have to get mad. I just stayed that way. So, and it was less trouble, because he never did anything to please me either, so I could just stay mad. And I was mad because I had worked that day, and he hadn't, and things had not gone well. And he told me again he wished he were dead. Now, I don't ordinarily cuss, but that day I cussed and I says, "Yes, and you son of a bitch, I wish you was dead and I'm going to finish you off this day." And I mean it. So he had been poisoning some wild dogs out at the farm, and he had put strychnine in hamburger meat and would throw it out, and these dogs would get it, you know. So I didn't want to go to all that trouble. I just got the strychnine off of this same little old closet shelf where the gun was. You know, I don't even know what's on that shelf today. I don't bother that shelf. But I got that strychnine, and I was poured it in a spoon, some in a spoon, and I said, "Open your mouth." And he said, "Uh-uh." And I was holding the spoon with one hand and the strychnine and trying to force his mouth open. And the phone rang. Now, I don't know why I stopped to answer it, but I answered the phone, and it was the printer. It was Bruce, and he says, he called me Buddy, and does today when he sees me, calls me Buddy, and he says, "Buddy, are you coming back to work today?" And I said, "No." He said, "Why?" I said, "I'm busy." And he says, "Well, we've got a job that needs to get out." I think it was football programs or something. And he says, "I really need your help today." And I said, "Bruce, I can't come back to work today. I'm busy." And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Killing Cody." And he said, "You're doing what?" And I said, "I'm killing Cody." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "The son of a bitch wants to be dead. I want him dead. I'm going to finish him off. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. I don't have time." And I hung up the telephone. So we live across the street from the Baptist church. I go to that church now, but the preacher left. So he called the preacher and he says, "Mom says, you're closer to her than I am. Says she says she's killing Cody. Says, will you go over there and see about her? Says, you know what a temper she's got. And says, she's tried it before." So he comes a-trucking across the backyard of the church and to my front door, and I could look out the room where I was. I could look out the window and see who was at the front door. And he knocked on the door, and I told him to go away. I was busy. And because I was still trying to make Cody open his mouth, and he wouldn't cooperate. And so he came around to the back door, and he came in, and he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm killing Cody." And he said, "Why?" And again, I told him just exactly what I had told Bruce, that the son of a bitch wanted to be dead, and I wanted to kill him, and I was finishing him off that day. I was through with it now. And he said, "What you got?" And I said, "Strychnine." He said, "Give it to me." I said, "Open your mouth." And he wouldn't open his mouth either. So we struggled over that bottle of strychnine, and he finally got it, and I kept telling him it was mine. But he got it, and he goes to the phone, and he calls his doctor friend of ours. And he says, "Olin says you better come see about Betty. Says she's trying to kill Cody. Says she's giving him strychnine. And says, you know, I think she's flipped her lid." And so, bless his heart, his wife is a nurse, and they closed their office, and they came and they spent the rest of that day with me and that night. And I'd move and they'd move, and I'd go to another room and they'd go to another room. And you know, I didn't give Cody a drink of water or anything that day. They wouldn't let me, and I don't know that I would have if they'd have let me. But we got through this, and Olin told me later that he was really concerned about me because he thought I really was losing my mind. And I wasn't losing it. I had already lost it. And so I had no problem with the second step in insanity when I really began to try to work this program. But we get through that. And Cody has a wreck. Now, I had gotten smart and had decided that he should take Anabuse. And so Olin had given him the Anabuse, and Cody would take Anabuse and drink and think he was going to die, and I'd wished he was going to die. And I told a speaker one time, she said, she held the world together, and I said, it's your fault I couldn't get Cody planted. You held it too tight. But we had been up with him all night that night, and the next morning he got up and he left the house. And I woke my youngest son up, and I said, Steve, your daddy's gone. And he said, oh, Mama, he's just gone to get a drink. And about that time, I heard a car coming down the street, and I looked out, and I saw Cody hit an oak tree in my new car. Now, he had bought me a new car. And that morning, he had his old truck and an old station wagon sitting outside, but he got in my new car to tear it up. He just demolished my car, but he almost demolished him. And by the time I got across the street, all the neighbors was there and the ambulance was there, and they said he's dead. Well, I passed out. Now, from relief or joy, you know. And so they put us both in the same ambulance. But he had pulled out all of his hair. He had hit the windshield and pulled out all of his hair and broke both collarbones and punctured his lung and broke all of his pelvis and his hip, and he was just broke up all over, and they thought he was dead. And they carried us both to the Bacon County Hospital, and they admitted me and found out he wasn't dead and sent him on to Waycross. Well, he stayed in the intensive care for 3 weeks. During this 3 weeks' time, you know, I had to occupy myself in the waiting room because I was being the good little wife. And so I occupied myself by planning his funeral and who I wanted for pallbearers. And one of the major decisions that I remember that I had to make was where I was going to bury him in the cemetery by his mom and daddy or in the hog lot with the hogs. Because he was happy at the hog lot. And that was a major decision, and I remember it very well. And that's how I passed my time. And twice they came out and they told me that he would not live and for me to call the family in. So I called his sisters and I called the 3 children. And so we'd walk the halls, you know, and he didn't die. He would get better. So the 3rd time they came out and they told me that he could not live more than a few more hours and to call the family. I said, no, I'm not going to call the family anymore. That it won't be any harder to call and say, well, boys, your daddy finally kicked off, you know, he finally made it, than to come down to the hospital and let's all walk the corridors. And I didn't call him. And he didn't die. So we didn't worry him for no good reason. And so after 3 weeks, he was moved into a private room. And he stayed in that private room then 2.5 months. Now, we stayed in that room. And in taking my inventory, I had to ask myself, why did you stay with him? If you really thought you wanted him dead, why did you stay with him? And I didn't ask those questions in the first inventory. I want y'all to understand that. I wasn't that well yet. But later on I did, and I had to be honest with me and say, one of the reasons that I stayed was because that's what was expected of me as his wife. I stayed. Another reason that I stayed was because the only thing that he could move was his 2 hands and his head and his mouth. And somebody had to wait on him continuously, 24-hour care, and we couldn't afford nurses. Because, you see, we had life insurance if he would die, but we didn't have any hospitalization, not a dime. And if you think you can't go to the hospital without hospitalization, you can. That's one of the inheritance our children's going to get is doctor and hospital bills, because we won't live long enough to pay all of his doctor and hospital bills, even today. We work on them, but we just won't get all those paid. And I would stand over him and I'd say, see what you've done to us. I would get my little digs in when I could. And then I had to admit that way deep down, I had at one time loved this man. He had been my entire life. And so I think that there was some love along with the hate. I was told in an Al-Anon program one night that I really didn't hate him, and that's their opinion. I know that I did. I literally hated the ground this man walked on at one time. I'm not proud to say that, but that's my feelings, and that's how I was. And I have to try to be as honest with you today as I can be, because that's how I'm going to grow in this program, is with the honesty. So he gets out of the hospital, and after staying there, and it was decided that we would take him to Augusta. And for the next 8 years, we were in and out of the hospital for months and months and months at a time. He had been told he would never walk again. And you can see he's well and happy. Well, how happy? You'll have to ask him that. But God has been good to us. And that was some of my reactions in the hospital. I had thought that this wreck would do something for me and for him, but it didn't scare either one of us into getting better. Now remember, I'm still going to Al-Anon every week. I'm going. Y'all are getting tired of it, but I'm going. I'm testing you. And we were still together, and I decided that I couldn't live like that anymore, so I filed for divorce. Now, the lawyer that I go to is an alcoholic lawyer. He took my case and Cody's. He represented both of us. And he would say, son, you might as well sign. She's going to get what you want. But now, I was being fair to him. I wanted the house, and I wanted the store, and I wanted the car, and I wanted the farm. I was letting him have the debts and his truck. Now, that's fair. That's fair. So this same lawyer represented us both, and we stayed separated. And the day that we were to get our divorce, I went by the store, and here again, I don't question anymore. I used to, but he was in there, and he was drinking, and I looked at him, and I said, come on, and I'll take you home. And I did. You see, there again is the insanity. I had put this man out of the house because he was drunk, and now I take him back home because he's drunk. You know, there was no consistency with me. So we got back together. We go to the program. Then he goes to Willenway. It is decided that he would go to Willenway. And we carried him to Willenway, and he had been there a week when he sent me word he was coming home. Now, he shouldn't have done that. I sat down and I wrote him a letter, and I don't like to write letters, but I wrote him a letter and I told him who he was and who he wasn't, what he was and what he wasn't, and where he could go, and it wasn't Bacon County if he left Willenway. So he stayed. And so the last 2 days, they called and asked me, was I going up there? And I told them, no, I didn't want to go to Willenway. I had no business there. Didn't want to go. Wasn't going to go. So I talked to the nurses and the different ones. And then Dr. John called. Well, you who knew Dr. John knows he has a pretty persuasive attitude about him. And so he just told me to get myself up there. And I went. And so Cody told me going home on Wednesday, he said, I'm never going to drink like that again. Now, I took it to mean that he was not going to drink again. But that's not what he said. That's not what he meant. Because Thursday at noon, he was drunk again. Well, you know, our youngest son, because I had written another bad check to Willenway, $1,500. and had to cover that check some way. And we did cut some pine trees. Our 15-year-old son cut those pine trees, cut them up into pulpwood, and sold them to cover that check that I had written to help his daddy. And then he had come home and got drunk again. But I thought, well, y'all talked to me at Willing Way, and so I'll try to practice a little bit of what you told me. I'll be tolerant and passionate, and I'll love him. So I washed his brow, you know, and I would feed him, and I waited on him, and I, to the best of my ability. And we got over that drunk. So things rocked along pretty good for 3 weeks, and he got drunk again. And I thought, if drink is what you want, old fella, drink is what you gonna do. And you gonna do it till you die. So I called another lawyer. Now I switch lawyers. And I called him and I said, Ed, and this particular lawyer is my sister-in-law's son-in-law. I said, is it a legal death to give Cody all he wants to drink until he dies? And he said, Betty, you don't want to do that. I said, yes, I do. I said, is it legal? And we talked about it, and he finally agreed that he didn't know anything illegal about it if Cody died from overdrinking, since he knew he had a problem with drinking anyway. So I go to the liquor store, and I wanted a case of Smirnoff 100, and he wouldn't sell me a case. He told me he would sell me 8 bottles. And we used to have a discussion, because that was also the first liquor I ever bought, about what size bottles they were. But here again was a bad check, and it was for $32 and a dime. And I wanted a discount, and he wouldn't give me a discount, and I told him that anything he came in my store and bought 8 of, you know, he got a discount, and we argued about that. But anyway, I took these bottles home, and I lined them up by the bed, 4 and 4. Now, I'm sort of a neat person. And so I said, Cody, you want a drink? And he said, yeah. And he just cooperated with me. And I had a little old paper cup there, and I'd pour that little old paper cup about half full of vodka, and I'd give it to him, no chaser, no nothing, you know, and he really was cooperating with me. And we had some AAs to come in, and they said, what you doing? And I said, killing him. And, and you know, and finally when I got all of them out, I locked all the doors and all the windows, and nobody could come in a window or a door. And so I just proceeded to do my thing, which was to give him something to drink. And every few minutes I'd ask him, did he want something to drink? And he'd say, yeah. And when he got where he couldn't hold that head up by himself, I held his head up with one hand and I poured it in him with the other. Twice he asked me for a drink of water. Now it's December the 10th and it's cold. It's freezing. I go in the kitchen. I take me a tea pitcher. I fill it up with ice cubes and water, and I go in. I stand over him, and I just turn that pitcher upside down. I had the wettest bed. I never got that bed dry. But twice he asked for water, and twice I did that. And you can teach a drunk something. He didn't ask for any more water, and he didn't do any more. So at 11 o'clock that night, I asked him, I says, Cody, you want another drink? Because I was out. I'd give him every smidgen in those 8 bottles. And now remember, he was already drinking when I started. He was not meant to die. I told him that the reason he didn't die is God didn't want him, the devil wasn't ready for him, and he was just left here to worry me. That's the only reason he didn't die. But I asked him at 11 o'clock if he wanted a drink, and he said, oh, no. So he would ask me to help him to the bathroom, and I wouldn't help him anywhere. And when he'd make a mess, I just left it for him to clean up. He made it, let him clean it up. And I went to bed and went to sleep. And I had a good night's sleep. And he tells in his story that he didn't want to be under any obligation to me. Now, I'd already give him 8 bottles. I don't know what one more would have bothered, but he didn't want to ask me to go get any more. And I wouldn't go without he asked me. He said he had a miserable night, and there again, I hoped he did then, and I hadn't changed my mind about that either. So I go to bed, and the next day I got up, and the first thing I asked him, I says, Cody, do you want a drink? And he said, oh, good God, no. All day long, I asked him, did he want a drink? And he'd say, oh, good God, no. And he'd say, take me to the doctor. I'd say, no, won't be no more doctor bills. Because I had carried him 3 weeks before and got him a shot, and it cost $15. And there wasn't going to be no more $15 shots. He could live or die, and I didn't care which, and he could do it the best way he could manage. And he had asked me to fix him a milkshake, and I'd say, no, if you want to fix it yourself, you know. So we got through that day. The next day was Wednesday, and I didn't bother him. He'd ask me to do something, I'd tell him no. That night, I said, I'm going to Al-Anon. I did not ask him to go to AA. Didn't care where he went to AA or not. Literally, he wasn't able to go to AA. But he said, if you'll wait a minute, I'll go with you. Now, he wears a white shirt. If he's on the tractor plowing or if he's at work, that's all he owns is a white shirt. And he said, I'll change my shirt and wash my face and go with you if you'll help me. And I said, get there the best way you can. Now, I did drive. We did go to the meeting, and we got there. He said, will you help me in? And I said, no, I'm going to get in on my own steam. You get in there the best way you can. And I went into the meeting. And he did go in that night. Now see, for 18 months I had been hearing the steps read. I knew that you were reading the steps. But this night I heard my first step. And the first step that I heard was number 11. And when I heard that step, I prayed the first earnest prayer of my life. I said, God, I cannot go on like this, whether he ever gets sober or not. I took that 11th step to the best of my ability that night. I took the 3rd step. I made a decision to change. I took the first step. I admitted my life was unmanageable. Now you see, I didn't take all of any 3 steps in the entirety. I took what I was able to take that night. Later, I had to go back and take those steps in the order in which they are written. I still have to take those steps. I don't think anybody that stays in this program ever gets through taking those steps or working on them. I may not consciously say I'm working number 3 or 10 or whatever today, but I have to be conscious that those 12 steps are in my life, that they are my life, that they're my sanity. So the next night we were in a meeting, and the next night we were in a meeting. And I'm grateful that we had to drive. We would have to drive 25 and 30 miles one way to get to a meeting. And we learned to talk in a car. Now, we first learned to communicate by me telling him what the speaker had said that applied to him. I don't know if any of y'all have done that or not. But one Sunday afternoon, we had gone from Alma to Waycross to a meeting, and then we were going from Waycross to Douglas to a meeting that night. And he made the statement, if I've got to go to these meetings for the rest of my life in order to stay sober, I just as soon die drunk. We're still going to those meetings. And thank God he is sober. We went because we had to. Now we go because we have to, and because we want to, and because we enjoy it. This program has been fantastic for me. And I got a little girl in my Al-Anon group at home that uses this word, and she uses it sort of loosely sometimes. But fantastic is what this program has been to me. It has given me many gifts. First of all, it's given me freedom. I'm free to walk in and out these doors or go where I want to, when I want to, and when I can afford it. But you see, if things had gone on, I would have been locked up somewhere because I would have killed this man. I know that today. With my temper, I would have managed. This program has given me a family, because when we had separated, as I told you, I had three boys. The oldest one was in Athens at school, and he made the statement to me, "Mama, if you'll stay in Bacon County, I'll stay in Athens, Georgia." And I, fine, I don't care. The middle son had stayed with me, not because he loved me more than he loved his daddy, but I just had a few more conveniences at the house that I was in than his daddy did. And besides, I cooked once in a while when I got hungry. The youngest son went with his daddy. He said, "If daddy goes, I go." And I said, "Fine, I don't care. I don't care. I don't care where I see you again or not." And that's literally how I felt. I didn't care. But this program taught me to care. And I used to ask my sponsor, because this youngest son had many resentments against me. And there were 7 years there that if he had to come into the room where I was, he wouldn't speak. He had nothing to do with me. And if he could possibly stay out of my way, he did. And he only came when he had to come. And my sponsor kept saying, "Give it time, work your program, and it will get better." There was a little problem in the family, and this child did come to me and asked me for some help. And I gave him the help that he asked for because I was able to do so. And we began to mend our bridges. Because you see, the only way that I could make amends to him was to show him that I had tried to change my life. And that his daddy and I were fairly happy in this program and together. And that I didn't hold the animosity and the hatred against his daddy that I had held. And that was the only way that I could make amends to him. Because I couldn't touch him. He wouldn't let me touch him. He didn't want me to speak to him. Today things are better with us. It's not all roses, but we can sit down and we can have a conversation. He can say, "Mama, I need your help. I can give it to you." But you know, I can let him make his own decisions. His daddy says I have detached to a point again too much because he's having a marital problem. But I'm giving him his right to make his decisions. And I could not have done this without this program. But I'm grateful that our fences are mending and that he can come in and say, "I'm hungry, what you've got to eat," or "do so and so." And I'm grateful for that. It's given me back a family. My oldest son is named Kim. He married a girl named Kim. Her mother's redheaded, and I'm redheaded. Her father's an alcoholic. His father's an alcoholic. Her father has 8 years of sobriety, about 9 now. Cody has 10. And you know, there's that common bond with all the names and the alcoholism in the family. We don't hide the fact that we're alcoholics. It's well known in Bacon County that we are. In fact, if your car is seen at my house, they say, "Well, I didn't know so-and-so was an alcoholic." And The principal of one of the schools came to see us one night, and one of my friends, their children came by, and they went home and said, "Mama, I didn't know Mr. So-and-so drank." And she said, "Well, he doesn't, then I know." "Well, why was he at the Cody's then?" My telephone rang one day, and I was talking to this lady from another town, and she was asking me about AA and Al-Anon, and I was telling her, and the town that she was living in is just full and has a great AA and Al-Anon group. And I said, "Well, I don't know you, and you don't know me." I said, "How did you get my name?" She said, "I called the Chamber of Commerce, and they told me." So we're not anonymous. Don't want to be. Because you see, Cody was well known as a drunk. And I'm glad that we're known as having sobriety in our home. We couldn't hide alcoholism or drunkenness, and I don't want to hide sobriety. This program has given me love, and I could identify with David this morning when he said he was alone, you know. And you're not alone, David, anymore in this program, and I found that out too. Because I couldn't love you. I couldn't receive your love because I couldn't love you. But now I can love most people. Now, I'm not one of these that say I love everybody. I'm not that well yet. But I can love most people, and I like nearly everybody. And it's given me that. I feel that one of the gifts it's given me, that God has given me, is the ability to share with you and hope that nobody has to go as far down the road as I did in order to get this program. It's given me a God of my understanding. I used to think that God was so far up in his heavens, you know, that he didn't hear anything that I had to say. But now I know that God does hear me, whatever I am saying to God, whatever my feelings are. He hears me, he understands me, and he loves me. It has given me the right to look at me. It has given me the courage to look at me. I've not always liked what I saw. And I laughingly say I don't have any character defects that I don't know about, because between my doctor, who is in the AA program, and Cody, they've told me all of them. But at least I am aware and can admit that I've got them. The 10th step in admitting when you're wrong and promptly doing something about it, and I don't like that word, promptly. I don't like to be that prompt in admitting that I'm wrong. It sometimes takes me a while to admit that I'm wrong. But at least I can. Most of the time now, I'd be lying to you if I told you I did it all the time, because I don't. I would be lying to tell you that everything was roses at my house, because it's not. But the worst days are better than the better days used to be. I am grateful that we're in this program. I can know that Cody loves me. You know, I've always wanted to be first in somebody's life, and I've made it. My oldest grandchild is a little girl. I didn't have any little girls, and God saw fit to give me a little girl and a grandchild. And I love this child better than anything in this world, even over her granddaddy. And he knows it, and she knows it. I don't hide it. I love all my grandchildren, but this one particular child has a bond, because I loved her the minute I saw her, and she's loved me all her life. And I feel good about that, and I don't feel any guilt about that. I try not to treat her any different than the others, but I do love her differently. And I feel that this is a gift that God gave to me. There's many gifts. God let Cody be where he can walk. Now some of y'all may think you've got the $6 million man. I know I have. He's got more artificial parts than he's got real parts. But he's mine, and I'm going to keep him. And I'm proud to say that today. And you know, another thing that God has given to me is to let me come and share with y'all. And you walk up, and you hug me, and you tell me you love me. And I know the ones that really do, and they don't. And that lets me go home and live with Cody when he don't hug me and tell me he loves me. He just shows me in his own way. And I firmly believe that that's why I am asked to speak sometimes, is so I can continue to have a happy home life and accept things as they are and not as I wish they were. I'm happy today, and that's something I wasn't in the past. I don't have any bitterness that I know of toward anybody. I don't have any resentments that I think of right this minute toward anybody. And for that, I'm grateful. I thank you for asking me, and I thank you for listening to me. I appreciate it. I appreciate being asked. And if there's any new ones in here, I encourage you, keep coming back. Because as the AAs and Douglas say, if Al-Anon can help Betty Cody, it can help anybody, and it can. Thank you.
I've eaten many a good meal at Betty Cody's house. It must take her some sort of courage, if she's mad at him, to sit his feet down at her table and eat. Betty, appreciate it very much.
Thank
Let's
you.
Close this meeting with a moment of silence. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I boo-booed. I was supposed to say the Lord's Prayer.
That's all right, too.
That's all right. That's all right, too.